work, but I kind of feel like I'm obligated to say something nice, or am I obligated to say something nice? Good morning. I was thinking a moment ago, I saw I forgot what I was going to say. You know what I want to do today? I want to explore Corinthians. That's really what I want to do. Isn't that exciting? I want to explore Corinthians. So what I'm going to bring us through, actually, is just, I'm going to bring you through some of my work in 1 Corinthians. I'm not going to do 2 Corinthians. I'm just going to bring you through my work in 1 Corinthians. And I've got a handout of how I've, my first stab at the book here. So I'll hand that out in a little bit, but I'll also tell you some of my process of how I go through it. And my hope for you this morning is that some of your own habits will be refined and maybe defined by just having a window into some of my own. All right, so here's some of our family updates. Here's what our budget looks like for week three. Ooh, I'm a week or two off. Week seven, forgot to update that part. Week seven and 63, we're at 49. And as I've said all the other weeks, really encourage each other to give with a grateful heart and to give regularly. That's a habit I think we can all do better at. But certainly you leaders that are encouraging and shepherding your people, let's continue to do that. Tonight, we have our love feast. It's a soup supper, correct? Soup supper. Somebody's excited about soup. Soup supper starts at 5. And I've got a little short little thing planned that I want to talk about. We ended the year last year and kind of gave, or not, excuse me, I got that wrong. In January, kind of gave an overview of what 2016, what we accomplished in 2016. And I'm going to do a version of that, which is, who are we, where are we at, and where are we going from a large perspective. So I'm gonna do a little bit of that tonight. We'll have more people that don't come to Sunday morning time. So I think that'll be a helpful thing for us. What else? I did see that there's a women's event April 1st. Is that right? Yeah. Nancy's surprised that I remembered that. April 1st, we're supposed to mark our calendars of that, but just the women. Okay, that's the women's event. All right, I think that's family updates. Okay, so this really captured me a few weeks ago when we saw this, when Jeff put this up here. I'll tell you, I think in our lives sometimes we have these floating pieces of a puzzle that are just floating out there, and over time, or sometimes for me, I have to work on that piece of the puzzle, work on it for years and years and years, and sometimes I forget it's even a piece of the puzzle, if you go with my metaphor there. And then all of a sudden I'll hear a statement, or I'll read something, or someone will say something to me in one sentence, and boom, I can fit that piece of the puzzle in. Like when Don Johnson and I had a conversation about shepherding, was not just about being right. It was actually about moving people along the developmental path. That was a moment in time where a piece of the puzzle just came in for me. And this one was, this is another piece for me, that Luther recovered the gospel. He really, faith alone. And Luther really recovered the gospel, but failed to build networks of churches on it. Really failed to, if you look at the book of Acts and how the church unfolded, and how it was built on the apostles' teachings, of what Christ and the apostles' teachings, he didn't build churches on that. And as a result, today, We have all kinds of secondary traditions that were built on it leading up to denominationalism, where you have a denomination that says, I stand on this teaching. And I stand on this teaching, and we all might pick a priority of the certain aspect of the teaching rather than the whole teaching that Christ and his apostles left for us. So this was I think this is something that is very important for us as a family as we recover the Antioch tradition, as we recover getting back to the early church model. It's really important for us to understand this statement. We have churches today that say, we follow the, and I'm pulling this from my own self, I guess. We say, oh, we follow, who are you? Well, I'm Lutheran. Or I'm Reformed. I follow John Calvin's traditions and teachings. Or I'm Southern Baptist. Or I'm Pentecostal and I'm defined by this. A lot of us may say that. If you remember, you remember this chart, some of you perhaps. This was from 3 or 4 months ago. These are the denominations and who started them, what year they were started, how they branched off because they believed this about baptism, or they believed this about profession of your faith, or they believed this about women's role, or... So we looked at this to some degree before last October, I think, or November. But the church around the world, this is my introduction to 1 Corinthians, because 1 Corinthians dives into this stuff. The church around the world is full of division and disunity. Consequently, the church around the world does not do theology in our culture. We don't engage our culture. Rather, we tell the culture what they need to believe in order to join our churches. This is what you need to believe in order to be a Lutheran or Baptist or Reformed. The church today is known for what we're against and is therefore irrelevant to an ordinary person's day-to-day life. In addition, the North American church mistakenly believes that it can accomplish God's purposes through religious or political means rather than aligning our lives with God's story and the teaching that is the Didache or Christ and his apostles' teaching that was left for us. In the context of the church, we fall for other agendas. So if our lives are not built on that teaching that's left, then it's really easy for us to fall for other agendas, get mixed up in what the political, being in the political scene, thinking that's the way our world is going to be put back together. When in fact the kingdom's been inaugurated, Christ inaugurated it, and when he comes back, will be the final culmination of it. But till then, we live in this time where he's introduced and inaugurated the kingdom, and now we're in the time between. We're in the age of the church. So, I think, and then we're gonna get right into Corinthians. So, my desire is for each of us to truly understand the kerygma didache on which we are built. I don't want any of us to be stuck building our lives on a secondary tradition that is stuck in that era of time. That, if you go back to this statement here, that's the piece of the puzzle that got put back together for me, is when I first went to South Africa, and I remember I brought some of all my Christian teaching that I had as a youth all the way up. And a guy came to me, it was actually Stanis Moliki, if some of you remember Stanis. But he came up to me and he said, Michael, really great stuff, but none of your Reformed teachings mean anything to us in South Africa. And that was a piece of me like died. because I realized that part of what I was basing my faith on was a secondary tradition. Was a secondary teaching. Now, I didn't have the words for it yet, but I knew at that moment that piece of the puzzle wasn't actually fitting. I had to actually discard that piece of the puzzle and put it over here. And I'm thankful for a lot of the disciplines I learned, very thankful for the disciplines I learned, but I'm also realizing it was a secondary tradition. And I'm also realizing that, and let me explain this stuck part, is a lot of times what I was doing in my life was I was taking what Calvin, Luther, and those reformers were doing and just trying to implement it in our day. But they were answering questions in their day. They weren't trying to answer cultural questions of our day. And so we have to, that's why we have to get back. We have to get back to the primary teaching and then do theology in our culture. We can't take something from 500 years ago and just transplant it to today. So that stuck part makes so much sense to me. We don't live in the time of the Protestant reformers. We live today. We live in a world that is asking questions about meaning and purpose, and by building our lives on the teachings of Christ and His apostles, we'll be able to provide answers to our present world. All right, so let's look at Corinthians. The city of Corinth, here's some background on the city of Corinth. This is from that James Dunn book, Beginning in Jerusalem. It's a big... Does anyone have any idea what I'm talking about? It's a big, thick one. Looks like this. Jeff would have it up there, right? I actually had it in the airport with me. We just got back with Sam and Jen. Had it in the hotel guy. I was like, what kind of book is that? And I said, oh, it's Beginning in Jerusalem by James Dunn. It's a great book. He goes, why would anybody read that? Well, let me tell you this. My desire is for you to truly understand. No. Two days journey from Athens, which I'll show you a map in just a second because that probably means nothing to you. This is why I had to have a map, because I didn't know, it didn't mean anything to me when I first read it. It's a center for trade, and it's really a business center. It's a hub for trade. It's a hub for trade coming in and out. And in 146 B.C., it was destroyed, and then Julius Caesar in 44 B.C. began to make it a hub for trading as a port. And by 5153, so let's say 100 years later, it was a booming place. A lot of business there that moved in and out. So there's a fair amount of wealth, they say, that happened that was in Corinth at that time, that Paul went to the Corinthian churches. There's about 80,000 people at the time in the city, is what they estimate. The principal competitors for a young church, for the young churches, would have been the well-established religious and civic cults. And I won't go into a lot of that. James Dunn does a good job explaining what those are. He has a whole big section on. And some of those we would identify with even today. And even the second one. The greatest social pressures would most likely have come from the associations, professional colleagues, business associates to which converts still belong. So James Dunn actually talks about that in their church meetings that Paul was referring in, 1 Corinthians 11 and 12. He's actually saying some of them aren't showing up regularly because they're going to their business meetings all the time. And I thought, man, this is like Paul's wanting them to make it a priority to meet regularly with their church family, and yet he says some of them, James Dunn's opinion is that they're not because they're busy with their business. All right, so Corinth is right here. Corinth is right here. Athens is right here. Thessalonica, the Thessalonian letters, of course, that we have first and second are right here. Philippi is right up here. So in 1 Corinthians, Paul mentions Timothy, and Timothy very likely had, when he was in Corinth, referenced in 1 Corinthians there, had just come from Thessalonica, working with the churches up in Thessalonica. So, but anyway, the main point I want to show you is just what the map looks like. Corinth is right here. So Rome, you can't see Rome, but Rome is right here, right over here. I love maps. Okay. Exploring Corinthians continued. Acts 18, if you read Acts 18, I'm going to read it for us really briefly here, but it gives us a lot of context for the Corinthian church. Luke shows, these are my words, but Luke shows divine assurance and providential events that confirm the work in Corinth. So if you, again, I'll read it for us, but Luke is just, all Luke is doing is in 18 short little verses, he's just saying, boy, this is what happened. And this is why it was confirmed. This is why we went to Corinth. Boom, this is why it fits into the whole plan of God. This is why it fits into what God's, the Spirit's doing, moving the church forward. Boom, Corinth is strategic for us. So if you read it in that light, it's very, that's what Luke is doing here. Claudius, expulsion of the Jews from Rome. So Claudius took the Jews and told them to get out of Rome. But what happened? Well, then Aquila and Priscilla were in Rome, got kicked out of Rome, and went to Corinth. Well, what happened? They began a partnership with Paul. Pretty big deal. Paul, nor did anyone else, have control over Claudius. So Luke is telling us, yeah, these two business people got kicked out, but they became fast partners with Paul. Paul also received a vision while he was in Corinth. And God said, I'll be with you, and there's going to be many people in this city, so stick around. There was also a favorable ruling of the proconsul Gallio in Corinth. He ruled that the public sentiment against the missionaries, like the ruling that happened in Thessalonica earlier, would not happen in Corinth, meaning Paul could be there without getting kicked out. So the leader there, Gallio, said, hey, the ruler said, hey, we're going to actually allow people like Paul to stick around in the city. So those are ruler, governmental things that happened, and then there's a vision that happened in conjunction of that, and that's what Paul tells us. So that's why they stick there. All right, let's read this real quick. After this, Paul left Athens. This is Acts 18, 1 through 7, as you can see by the very poor formatting. After this, Paul left Athens, went to Corinth. There he found a Jew named Aquila, native Pontus, who had recently come from Italy, Rome, got kicked out of Rome, with his wife Priscilla. Because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome, Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, that is a tent maker, but mainly leather making, he stayed with them, and they worked together. And by trade, they were tent makers. So Luke just tells us very quickly that, hey, this is what God was doing. These people got kicked out, and they were in business together now. Every Sabbath, this is now Paul, every Sabbath he would argue in the synagogues and would try to convince Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, that is very likely Thessalonica, if you remember the map up north and it came down, it's a pretty long plane ride, I think. Paul was occupied with proclaiming the word, testifying to the Jews that the Messiah was Jesus. When they opposed and reviled him, in protest he shook the dust from his clothes and said to them, your blood will be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on I will go to the Gentiles. Then he left the synagogue and went to the house of a man named Titus Justus, a worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the official of the synagogue, became a believer. So here all of a sudden you've got a guy, Titus Justus, who very likely was a, according to Dunn, was part of the synagogue, but he was a worshiper of God, so which means he was a God-fearer. And then you've got this other leader, Crispus, the official of the synagogue, which they believe was a very... the official of the synagogue means that you managed the money of the synagogue, which means you knew how to deal with money, and you knew how to handle conflicts with money, because money tends to bring out the worst in all of us, and you probably had great wealth as well. So this Crispus guy, pretty influential guy, became a believer. And together with all of his household, many of the Corinthians who heard Paul became believers and were baptized. Now he switched to a different idea. He says, one night the Lord said to Paul in a vision, do not be afraid, but speak and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will lay a hand on you to harm you, for there are many in this city who are my people. He stayed there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. And then he moves on to this short paragraph. And remember, Luke puts this next door that he saw a vision and that no one's going to lay a hand on Paul. Then he says this next paragraph. He says, but when Gallio, with the proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul and brought him before the tribunal. They said, like, attack on Paul, like they're going to lay a hand on Paul. They're gonna fight him out of the city. Say, get out of here. But they said, this man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law. Just as Paul was about to speak, Paul was about ready to defend himself, Gallio said to the Jews, if it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, I would be justified in accepting the complaint of you Jews. But since it is a matter of questions about words and names of your own law, see to it yourselves. I do not wish to be a judge in these matters. And he dismissed them from the tribunal. So he said, I'm not gonna make a ruling that says Paul has to stop what he's doing. I'm not going to deal with it. You people deal with it. You guys deal with it within your own. Because at that point, they were still kind of viewed as a piece of Judaism from a governmental standpoint. And so he said, I don't want to deal with this. Which really was a blessing. And he dismissed them, and then what happened? And then the Jews seized the guy, the official of the synagogue, and beat him. So that was fun for him, I'm sure. But Gallio paid no attention to any of these things. So this is the background that Luke gives us about Corinth. So it's a very, very, all these things happened in Corinth. So here's some other background ideas about Corinth. Some of these we already know, but Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and 6 months, 18 months, and we get that from Acts 18 that we just read. We also know that Paul wrote a previous letter to the Corinthians before 1 Corinthians. So, and we get that from verse 9 of chapter 5. I wrote to you in my letter, he says, in 1 Corinthians. So, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate, and on that Caleb talked to us about last week. So there's another letter out there. In all the scholarly academic books, they call it Corinthians. And then we have 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and then there's 4 Corinthians, but they call it Corinthians. So there's a Corinthian letter out there before 1 Corinthians. And you can see that. Once you know that, and then you read 1 Corinthians, you can see hints of it that are even about as obvious as this one I bring up for you. The other thing I wanted to share here before we get into I show you my outline here, is Paul got reports from the Corinthians. When you're reading this letter, you're like, how did Paul know? Like, he didn't get emails, he didn't get text messages. Like, he didn't have cable news. Like, how did he know these things were happening in Corinth? All the things that he gives a report on or responds to. So these three guys, characters, these three members of the community of the Jesus followers in Corinth carried a letter or information about Corinth over to Paul. And you get that in these two verses. So he says, I rejoice at the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus, whatever, because they have made up for your absence, for they refresh my spirit as well as yours, so give recognition to such persons. So these three people carried information back from Corinth, refreshed Paul's spirit, but gave him a lot of the things very likely that you see in these letters about what the Corinthian churches were struggling with. But we also have Chloe. She returned from doing some business in Corinth, and told Paul about some additional problems. So her they don't know if it's her, Chloe's people. It's both Chloe's people and Chloe, but here's what Paul says to the Corinthians in the first chapter here. For it's been reported to me that Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you, my brothers and sisters. And then he continues on to try to explain what some of those are. All right, so that's, when I first read a book, honestly, probably one of the first things I do is I look in Acts. I always go to Acts, the book of Acts first, and try to figure out, did Luke, Paul, write us anything about this city, people group, churches in Acts? That's honestly a great place to start. So if it's Thessalonica, if it's Philippi, you can get a quick context from what Luke wrote us in Acts. It's a great place to start. And as you can tell, Luke is for Corinth anyway, he just does three big picture items. Boom, this happened. Boom, this all vision. Boom, the guy said, I don't want to get involved in all your family skirmishes, so I'm not going to make a ruling against it. All right, so let me tell you some other my habits. I use something called the Books of the Bible, which is I'm sure some of you perhaps have this. Now, I have it on a Kindle, and what it is, it has no chapters and no verses. It looks like that. And what happens is you read it kind of like you read a book, a regular book. Like, imagine that. It's just a book. Or I sometimes, especially in this form, I read it and I'm like, oh, this is just an email. It's an email. Now, I know that sounds a little, especially if you're, oh, man, that's really sacrilegious, Michael. Well, no. It's actually a letter from one person to another set of people. So there's a purpose in here, and some people today are better writing than emails than others, but there's a purpose, and then he has reasons why he's supporting that purpose. And when you get away from all this stuff below the line and all these markers and everything, boy, just the letter, just reading it as a letter really comes out when you read it this way. And so what I do is I'll read it on my Kindle, and that's mainly because it's mobile. You don't have to read on a Kindle, but it's really mobile for me. I got all the books of the Bible here. I'm sitting in the airport waiting for a plane, on the plane, whatever. I can read Ephesians. You can read Philippians in 15 and a half minutes as a letter. But then there's highlights. I use highlights and marks. And I'll highlight it and I'll say, this is a new idea, new idea. And then I'll come to another one and say, oh, this is a new idea. And so you can start seeing his argument as he lays it out. And then, and you can come up with your own system, but there's four types of highlights in here. And for me, the blue is always a new idea. Yellow highlight is an idea that I want to remember. But blue finds its way into here. All right, but then I take these highlights. What Kindle actually does for you is everything that you highlight, it then syncs it into the cloud, and then I can go onto my computer, and I can just see all my highlights from the book. So I can see all my blue highlights. Now, what is kind of bad about it is you don't know what chapter and verse the highlights are. You just see the words. But at first I was kind of irritated about that. But what it actually makes you do is it actually makes you go back to the text. This is my habits again. It makes you go back to the text and actually find the chapter and verse. And so what ends up happening to me is I end up having to read like 50 verses ahead, 50 verses behind it until I actually find it again. So you actually end up reading the book twice. I didn't say my method was efficiency. I'm going after comprehension of the book here. But I take those highlights and notes, and I find the chapter and verse references. I organized the outline in the document while reading it again for clarity. And then I put my first attempt at an intention of what I think the author's intention is of the book. Because again, when you're reading it as a letter, when you're reading it without chapters and verses and without any headings and everything, you just read it for what it is, there's a couple, they tend to just pop out at you. For he says, "For I am writing this so that," that's the purpose of the book, the purpose of the letter. So that kind of stuff, it just comes out, and you put together your first intention statement. So this, would somebody help hand these out? Somebody, as in bodies. I don't know if that's enough, maybe. What you're looking up at the screen, this is the Kindle version of Books of the Bible, Marvin.
Never mind.
Here, I'll give you some. This is 28 verses that you're looking at on the screen. So just to give you an idea. All right, so I'm going to do what Bill Burns says never to do. He says, always start with confidence, never apologize. But I have not proofread this at all. I typed it once and haven't looked at it again. So hopefully, Sam, we were not on the golf course when this happened. So all I've done at this stage, this is my first stab at it, all I've done is taken my highlights and then put them into these sections. So this right here, this top, is what I believe I took. I actually see it got printed, but if you look at the back, his purposes for writing are XYZ, these are just the bullets, these are just the notes that when I was reading, I just quick took a note and said purpose statement. And so I came up with six potential times that he gave his purpose statement in the book. So now I'll go back and do some further investigation and see if my first stab at it was right. But again, I'm just showing you how I explore Corinthians, how I get my head in the game, so to speak. So then I take those, and I reread those just all together, and then I flip it around, and then I write this statement here. I try to stay close to the author's words. I don't try to come up with make up my own words, but I do try to, I do put it in my own words, but I don't try to use... I stay away from right-clicking on the word and looking for a synonym, because I want to use the word that the author used as best I can. So you want to put it in your own words, but you don't want to get so creative that you're just, you know, using synonyms all the time. You stay close to the author's intent. So my first stab at why 1 Corinthians was written was to set them straight in the teachings that were delivered to them, standing firm and being unshakable, addressing their specific concerns while continuing to build on the gospel that he first brought them. That's he wants to build on that first gospel, but he wants to set them straight and have them stand firm. And that's, if you read those verses on the back, that's what I believe he's in essence saying. Now, the other thing I noticed about 1 Corinthians is there's a part, the first part of 1 Corinthians is he is addressing the reports he's received, very likely from Chloe, from Stephanus, four guy, F guy, and then the other guy. those three guys, or actually, could have been ladies. I didn't research that, I guess. But those three people, and he responds to at least these three things. There's disunity, and so he deals with disunity in the first four chapters. He dives into some other territory for a while, but you get the sense that he's talking about being one-minded, being of one mind, being staying on the pathway. Then he deals specifically in just 12 verses of dealing with people who claim Christ but do not put aside immoral ways. This is what Caleb was mentioning with 1 Corinthians 5 last week. But the whole big, large principle there is that people claim to be followers of Christ and have claimed to be followers of Christ for an extended period of time, and they're not. They're not following the teachings. And so that's why at that stage, then Paul is saying you gotta put him out because he's being a hypocrite, basically. Chapter 6, we've got people that are bringing lawsuits against each other, and James Dunn does a really good job explaining the historical context of bringing lawsuits. It's not like how we bring lawsuits to each other today. It's different, but won't go long into that. James Dunn goes a long ways into that. But that appears to be a section, those three sections. And then chapter 7, he says a very interesting sentence. He says, "Now, for the matters you wrote me about." So at first he wants to deal with he wants to deal with a couple of things that he's gotten reports on. And then in chapter 7, he moves on to, okay, now I'm going to respond to your email. Here's what I want to tell you, and now I'm going to respond to you, is what appears to happen in chapter 7 there. And then they asked him evidently about marriage, divorce, being single, about the body, about dealing with food that is sacrificed to idols. A lot of the civic cults of that time, they would go to these dinners and have these idols and... Can we participate in that? It's a thing of our culture. Can we do that yet? Can we not? Do we be black and white on it? That's the questions that you can tell that they're asking in chapter 8 there. Chapter 9, he's defending his stewardship as an apostle. So there's some people that are questioning him, saying, he's just a silly farm kid. I don't know. He's just a silly leader. We don't really need to follow him. And so he's defending his apostleship there in chapter 9. Chapter 11 through 15, I didn't quite know what to do with this one. So I think the overarching principle there is by reminding them to stand firm in the good news he delivered to them. And then he chases these, I think there's four or five things that they asked him that he all fits into being firm in the gospel, which is Christ is the head, and he talks about men and women's roles and how the church is a family, and men are supposed to be leaders of the household. It's a family of families. I think he chases meals at the assembly meetings. He's chasing how go back to the civic cults, a lot of the meals, the rich people would show up first and eat. And that was very, very common in the civic cults. You may be thinking real negative about that, but it's not necessarily, it's like an association. And very, very common that the wealthy would come first, and they would come at different times. So sometimes you read 1 Corinthians, you're like, why are people showing up at different times? Well, James Dunn will say that he thinks they meet in the morning at the same time, and then they meet again on the evening, but they come at separate times. But they share a meal. But in the morning they have a teaching. That's what James Dunn believes. I was like, ooh, that's interesting. Never read that before. But in the evening one, you show up at different times, which that'd be really true for our church. understanding the Spirit's work in part of chapter 12 there and all the way through 14, reminding them of the good news, which is really just the purpose of that whole section. So I don't know if that needs to stand out on its own when I see that now. And then there were some really doubting the resurrection. And so he talks about how important that aspect is to the faith. And then he ends the letter, 24 verses. When you read it, it's just, you can lose your ball in the weeds in 1 Corinthians if you just don't have the big framework for it, I think. You're like, what in the world is he talking about? Why is he talking about this? Well, I think these are the reasons he's saying it. But he ends with his travel plans and details about the collection and honoring other leaders. So he says, hey, by the way, here's my travel plans. Here's my calendar. Here's where I'm going to be. Here's when I'm going to come. Hey, guess what? I talked to you about the budget. I already talked to you about it. But remember, here's the deal. I want you to gather it weekly. That way, when I show up, you don't have to make a big event about it 6 months from now when we got a big event and collect all this money. Collect it as you go along. Please. You know, so that's what he's saying. And then he says, these other leaders that I'm sending to you, honor them. So it's so practical in many ways. So that's what he ends the book with. All right. That's all I have, really. How about this? Let's talk a little bit. Always confused. When are we supposed to be done? 10 o'clock. Thank you, Eric. Is that you, Eric? It was the other Eric. Oh, it was Mark. We're supposed to be done at 10:21. It's 10:18. So, all right. Why is it important for us to understand the author's intention and outline or design of a letter? Why does that help? Why does it matter? I'm not suggesting that everyone has to always do this, but I am suggesting it is a really helpful thing to do. I don't know how much time I put into, for me, I just kind of do this as I live. I find pockets of time and that's why Kindle is so nice. You just highlight, you just read for 5 minutes and then you got to go do this. And then you read for five more minutes later. And by the end of the day, I think I had 1 Corinthians read in our first Monday of our trip, Jen and Sam. In your own reading of Corinthians, what things have you learned? So I hope in the last 2 weeks you've maybe read Corinthians at least once. So I'm curious about what you've thought about, what you've learned in the book. And then I want to know about number three here. Why is understanding the author's intention, letter design, important aspect for doing theology in our culture? Tying it back to the whole denominational thing that I started with, why is it important for us to, if you can get your hands around Paul's real intention, not the secondary teachings, traditions that we've come up with around, take for instance the Lord's Supper. It's a supper. In fact, it's really, you could transliterate it as the Lord's dinner. Now that, like, oh boy. You know, it's not necessarily a cracker. Now, we can use a cracker, but it's a dinner. It's a sharing of the dinner and the meal together. So, but if you don't know all this, if you don't know all of this, how easy is it for you to lose your ball in the weeds and not do theology and culture, but tell everyone when they come to your church, this is how we do it and this is how you need to do it? Why is understanding the author's intention, letter design, an important aspect for doing theology and culture? All right, we'll come back in a little bit and see what your thoughts are. You always do a good job making eye contact, Britta. I like that about you. You're confident enough to make eye contact. You like eye contact. It's intentional. All right, Marvin. Marvin's got the mic.
All right.
What's up, Marvin?
Here we go.
Here we go.
Why is it important to understand the author's intent and the outlining design of the letters so that we won't be like the Corinthians and get it all messed up?
we're a lot better than the Corinthians.
And two, in yep. our own reading of Corinthians, what have or things have you learned not to be like the Corinthians and get it twisted?
All right.
But why is understanding the author's intention and the letter's design an important aspect of doing theology and culture? Now, theology and culture, I have to word it in ways that I understand it. So, yeah. Theology, Christ, and life. Better yet, culture in my life. Okay, so what does God mean in my life? And why is understanding the author's intent is so that when I go to present it to someone else that's not of my culture or, one of those type of... when I go to explain it to someone else that isn't black, like myself or something like that, that I don't get it twisted and or, set the author's intent back any further than what it's than what it was. To bring it up to date, to as to what I see it as, which might not be right. The wording is very, very carefully mm-hmm. picked out. Because you just don't want to. Get anyone lost in what the true intent of the Corinthians letters were. Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's interesting that if you kind of pull your mind back for a second, God knit, he left words in a book. He could have left it any other way. He could have done anything, but he left it. Words on a page. And so for us understanding what those words mean, the intention that you're speaking of, we've really lost track of, we put it in a sermon in our Protestant cultures of the last 500 years, we put it in a sermon, and that's the bedrock of the Sunday morning church. But whether that actually every person gets their mind and heart in the actual intention of those words is a different matter altogether. Different thing. Todd.
Well, he wrote them a letter. Talking about number three, he wrote them a letter. He's laid it out, an argument, in a way that he intended to present it, and he's ultimately trying to drive them to a result of some kind. And
yeah.
As your design and intention lays out, I mean, he's not only are we getting his teachings, kind of in the way, but he's also teaching us how he's dealing with the problem. So he is, kind of taking control of the narrative. He's taking control of the discussion by laying out, the corrections for the things that he's received, and he wants to, kind of take control of how things are going to move forward. But then he takes on the issues that they sent to him, responds to them, and is ultimately driving them to the same message, but he's working that throughout the letter. So he's not just addressing a bunch of disparate issues, but he's really teaching us how to deal with some of that too. So I mean, it's the understanding literary design is kind of one of those things you don't always want to do, but you can see in a letter like this, it's not just the necessarily the teachings within it that are always the only key to it, but there's also a matter of how he's dealing with situations that really helps us out.
Yeah, that's really good. These are all integrated to an overall purpose. I like what Todd said there. At the beginning, he's taking control of the narrative. Tim, Titus. Titus with a U.S. You don't spell Titus like Titus in Corinthians, do you?
Nope.
That's too bad. You'd be cooler if you did.
I'm good. It's easier to spell with 5 instead of 6. So the intent. I've had conversations with quite a few people that are professed to be believers, and the conversation goes something like, for example, the one I had at Halo's Super Bowl party, the guy was, I can pray wherever, I can pray at a Muslim mosque, whatever, as long as I'm praying to God. And I was like, okay, so the guy's name. I'll use a different conversation. So a girl named Remy, we were talking about God, and she's like, basically, I pray to God, but when I don't need to read the Bible because I can't justify the death and stuff in the Old Testament with a God who says he's loving and all these things. And I was like, okay, so Remy, this is who you say you are, and I know you, so if I go to somebody else and I say, this is who Remy is, then they come to you, they know who you are. But if this is who you say you are, and I go to somebody else and say that you're something completely different than who you actually say you are, or who you are, then they don't know you. Mm-hmm. And so I get to, or I say, Remy, this is who I think you are, or who I want you to be, so this is who you're going to be to me. So our relationship is one that I'm functioning with my chosen beliefs about who they are. So the same goes to a passage or to God, where I get to define, if I interpret a passage however I want it to be interpreted, I make God out to be whoever I want him to be. Mm-hmm. And so we see that in all the different denominations, where it's, well, this is what I choose to believe, instead of what is God actually saying? Who is he actually, and how does it play itself out into how we do our practice, how we meet, how we function as a church? Because mm-hmm. if it's, I want to define him as a God who spiritual gifts are this way, and this is yep. how we need to worship him, then that sounds good to me, and I'll go over here. And it switches the picture from him to me. Mm-hmm. It's about me instead of it being about him. So we redefine who God is, and we lose the picture of who he is when mm-hmm. we lose the intent of the mm-hmm. passage. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that made sense or not, the analogy.
You got to be able to see the whole forest. I think what Todd and you are basically saying is that if you can, I think you can look at this and start coming up with and align some of the denominations, Protestant denominations, based on just one of these lines. How about the Lord's Supper? How long the Protestants been debating that one? You got a whole series of denominations that come out of just that one. But you lose sight of all these other things, and you lose sight of the whole big intention of the book, which is what you're saying then, is you're really believing what you project on. Eisegesis instead of exegesis, right?
So yeah, it's the person of Christ that matters. It's not, everything else falls back onto who he is. And so mm-hmm. as soon as I say that these things are different, it changes who he is mm-hmm. in my mind.
All right, one more. And then it'll be 10:21.
My name's Joe.
Hi, Joe.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you. You know, when we looked at those three questions, what we talked about as a group, too, was that when somebody writes a letter, they're trying to communicate a thought or an idea. Paul's trying to communicate to Corinth, which was one of the most depravative towns of that area, mm-hmm. Of that time. And he was bringing them the gospel. And there's a lot of things going on when you write a letter. There's the time that it's being written, where it's writing from. Like in Romans, he's writing it from prison. But, I mean, there's a lot of things going on. And so when we read the letter, if, as we pointed out in many different people here, if we read it with what we think it says, most of the time we're wrong. Mm-hmm. We have to look at what was going on in the letter, what he was trying to say, what was going on in the area and in the culture at the time. And that happens a lot in, like we were talking about the Reformation and how there's denominations that have come up. We begin to, as Titus said, we begin to define God, and we depend on certain actions to do that. And Paul, I think, was trying to get them to realize that there is structure in everything, but it's all spiritual. The work is done by the Spirit of God. Mm-hmm. And so in reading that letter, it's like it was pointed out. He reads, first of all, he says, okay, this is the structure of the church. This is what we need to do. Mm-hmm. And then later on, these are the questions that we're all asking me because we're all concerned in our day-to-day lives. And then today, we are so many things that we're concerned with. Mm-hmm. Our new president, the things that are going on, different life or culture questions. And we have to address those. And we have to address those in the light of what the Lord says and not what we think. Mm-hmm. And not get our own personalities and our own logic into it. And we do that sometimes, many times.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joe. Good to have you here. All right, let's pray and be done. Lord, we thank you for this time that we could look at Corinthians. We thank you for the discussion that we just had, and we ask that that discussion would bring each of us individually and collectively a clarity on what you're doing and what it is that you've left for us. Lord, as Joe said, as Titus, Todd, and Marvin all said, that we want to know what your intention is and was. So as we walk down that road together, we ask that you would continue to be with us as we are established and set straight and firmly rooted in your good news. So until we come back together as a network of churches tonight, I ask that you would bless us and keep us. In Christ's name, amen.